Let me begin this morning by commending you on showing up. If you're like me, you have no idea what hour it actually is, but you figure if you just came to church, you are bound to hit a service somewhere. Let me also commend you for being here because it is the start of spring break and many of our friends, particularly in the neighborhood to our immediate north, are away for vacation and rest. But you're here, so you're subject to my whims. I'm sorry for that. And my whim is to keep you on your toes, keep you sharp. I don't want you, falling too far back over spring break. So we're going to start today with a pop quiz. There is but one question. I'm afraid it is not multiple choice, but it is multiple part. Yes? A bit of compare and contrast. The question for this morning's pop quiz is, what do the following phrases have in common? What do the following phrases have in common? Added bonus, final outcome, and plan ahead. Got it? If you answered they are all redundant phrases, give yourself full credit. They are redundant phrases. Phrases that use more words than are strictly necessary to denote mere sense. Now, I admit, nobody gets very bothered about redundant phrases except people like me, people who idolize Henry Higgins and William Sapphire and read Strunk and White's Elements of Style the same way we read the Bible. The radio program we enjoy most is Away with Words. Now, the technical term for people like me is grammatical prescriptivists, because we like to prescribe the way the English language should be used. We're very interested in the rules and the ins and outs of grammar. There's another term for people like me, but it cannot be used in a sermon. We grammar prescriptivists are, frankly, grammar snobs who cannot tolerate comma splices, split infinitives, dangling modifiers, or placing prepositions at the end of sentences. Though I am hasty to note, we're very glad to tell you where, in fact, you can put your prepositions. We grammar prescriptivists are the safety patrol of the English language, and there are few things that we relish more than wielding red pens and spilling copious amounts of ink on unsuspecting essays. And nothing invites our ire quite as much as redundant phrases. Both plans and reservations are, by definition, made in advance. It's no such thing as an advance reservation. If you expected the surprise, well, then it wouldn't really be a surprise, would it? The fact that the car is an import tells you it is therefore foreign. And all mistakes are unintended. There may be unforced errors, but all mistakes are unintended. I suppose Madison Avenue has something to do with this. Yes? No. Lewis is a PR professional. Madison Avenue has something to do with this unfortunate grammatical phenomenon. Redundancy, I think, seems to make things better. Now, there's no doubting an actual fact. All the other facts, I guess, are just made up. An added bonus must be a very special treat. And an invited guest must have the inside track over all the other guests, but don't ask me how they knew how to show up for the party. And finally, what could be better than a free gift? Free gifts are just the best, don't you think? The only problem with a free gift is that it usually comes with purchase, which means you have to pay for it, which makes it an unfree gift, which means it really isn't a gift at all, which is why we grammatical prescriptivists are seldom invited guests at cocktail parties. We ruin everybody's fun. And so you can imagine the kind of fits we grammatical prescriptivists have when the Apostle Paul talks about the free gift 5 times in 3 verses of his letter to the Romans. According to the rules of Strunk and White, that is aggravated redundancy, punishable by up to 100 lines of "I will not use superfluous words." But we grammar prescriptivists are all about the rules, and a cardinal rule of biblical interpretation is anything that's repeated 5 times in 3 verses has to be important. So we can't simply ignore the free gift, nor can we mark it out with our grading pens. What grates on my ears is actually music to the soul. For this undeniably redundant phrase captures the essence of the full measure of God's love for you and for me. What God offers each of us is, in fact, a free gift. The free gift is God's grace. We Methodists like to talk a lot about grace, but we're not always careful to say what it is we mean by grace. Our founder, John Wesley, said that all the blessings which God has bestowed on men and women are of God's mere grace or bounty or favor, God's free, undeserved favor. Favor altogether undeserved. Human beings have no claim to the least of God's mercies. It is by God's grace that human beings were created. It is by God's grace that human beings are given dominion over the earth. It is by God's grace that you and I rise each day and eat our food and go to work or enjoy beauty or music or poetry. Grace is both what God does in us and what God does for us. Grace is also a solution to a problem. Now, the problem may not be one we think much about or devote a lot of time and energy to, except perhaps during Lent, which calls on us to think about this particular problem. And the problem I have in mind is sin. Sin involves our occasional moral failings, the sort we confess when we say, "Forgive us our trespasses," or pray the prayer of confession, as we will do in a few minutes. Sin is doing those things which we ought not to have done and leaving undone those things which we ought to have done. But sin also goes deeper than that. Sin is also a power capable of altering the structure of reality. Did you catch that? Sin is also the power capable of restructuring reality. In last week's sermon, we talked about erosion, that force that has the power to break things down and that alters the landscape. Sin is just as powerful a force, and it has the same consequences. The reading from Genesis today told us that when Adam and Eve took the serpent's word for it and ate the fruit they had been expressly told not to eat, well, that changed everything. Their rebellion, their disobedience, their insisting on being like God on their own terms, in short, their sin altered the structure of reality. They were forced to leave their lovely furnished garden apartment. Work was no longer something pleasurable, but it became a burden and ceaseless toil. The human's easy and immediate access to the presence of God was interrupted. Barriers to God were thrown up. And worst of all, death became an awful reality. And so, says St. Paul, sin entered the world through the one man, Adam, And death entered the world through sin. And now death has spread to all people because all people have sinned. Now, chances are that being mainline Protestants, we don't think much about sin. That seems to occupy the minds of several of our friends on different parts of the spectrum, but not mainline Protestants. Maybe we're not too concerned about it because it's with us all the time. And we're inclined to sin simply by virtue of our being human. But we're also inclined to downplay that part of who we are. As Will Willimon has noted, much of the time we get away with the fiction that we are, after all, down deep, rather nice people who have no need of salvation. We know we may not be the best people in the world, but we also know that we're not the worst. We're making spiritual progress, we're lifting ourselves up out of the muck and mire of what once was called sin. It's now fashionable in mainline denominations like ours to call sin something else, to call it something like brokenness or being lost or being sick. But as Barbara Brown Taylor points out, abandoning the language of sin will not make sin go away. Human beings will continue to experience alienation, deformation, damnation, and death, no matter what we call them. Abandoning the language of sin will simply leave us speechless before them and increase our denial of their presence in our lives. But Paul isn't going to have any of that. Paul will not let us get away with either the delusion that when it comes right down to it, we're pretty decent folk, nor will he let us off by denying sin's reality. Instead, Paul confronts us with the reality that sin is universal, saying in a different part of his letter that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. His main point in this part of his letter to the Romans is that sin was introduced and somehow passed on to the entire human race by Adam, our first parent, so that we were all made sinners as a result of Adam's disobedience. And because you and I share in Adam's sin, so also we share in Adam's punishment, which is ultimately death. But there is an answer to this predicament. There is a solution to this problem, and that is grace. Paul calls it the free gift. The gift of God's grace is the answer to the predicament of sin, in that grace is God working actively to solve sin's problem. If the problem created by sin is rebellion against or disobedience to God, grace remedies the breach caused by each. And grace took on the fully human form of Jesus. When the devil tempted Jesus with rebellion and disobedience by offering Jesus bread when he was famished, by offering Jesus worldly power when he had none, he was, after all, just beginning his public ministry. When the devil tempted Jesus by offering him escape from harm, from the suffering that would be his as the Son of God, Jesus remained obedient because he was fully aligned with God's purposes. When Jesus was tempted by the popularity of adoring crowds, when he was being chased by paparazzi, when people sought his autograph, when people wanted him to touch them because of the miracles he performed, Jesus remained obedient because he was fully aligned with God's purposes. When Jesus was tempted to forego suffering and death in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus remained obedient because he was fully aligned with God's purposes. Ultimately, of course, Jesus became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And that was the purchase. Jesus purchased our pardon on Calvary's tree. And Jesus was obedient to the point of death because he was fully aligned with God's purpose to save us from both the guilt and the power of sin. And so Christ, by his obedience, has overcome what Adam did by his disobedience. Adam's disobedience led to sin and death. Jesus' obedience leads to forgiveness and life. And that, friends, is the gift of grace. Grace is God acting in Jesus' death and resurrection to forgive our sins and deliver us from sin's power. Grace is God loving us enough not to leave us or abandon us to our rebellion and disobedience. Grace is God stepping into the breach those things cause and bridging the gap between us by way of the cross. Grace is God being so intent on having a relationship with us, a right relationship with us, that God was willing to go all the way to death and back. All of this then is God's gift, God's free gift, because God chooses freely to offer it, and chooses to offer it free to you and me. Indeed, God's grace is offered to everyone who knows that they are sinful, however they name it. Whether you know that you are broken, whether you know that you are lost, whether you know that you are tired of the way the world demands you work and you simply can't, or whether you say, Lord, I am a sinner. God extends God's grace to you and to me, offering us pardon and forgiveness and love and the possibility and power for transformation. Friends, ours is the gift, because Christ's was the purchase.